This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the historian Miles Unger, speaking with us today about the life and thought of Niccolò Machiavelli, born 500 years ago in Florence, but whose name still serves as synonym for immorality, cynicism, and betrayal. Your new book, Miles, suggests that the adjectives are misleading. The godfather of modern political science was not a crime boss, his thinking far more enlightened and humane than commonly supposed. Maybe you can begin with the city of his birth in what was the golden age of the Italian Renaissance.
Well, Machiavelli was a citizen, a proud citizen of the Republic of Florence. And Florence was, during the early years of his life, one could argue, undergoing a golden age. It was the age of Lorenzo de' Medici and of the great artistic achievements of Leonardo and Michelangelo. By the time he reached adulthood, Florence had fallen on hard times politically, even culturally. It had gone through the traumatic period of Savonarola when he was a young man and the invasion by the French armies in 1494. And so he grows to maturity and his thought grows to maturity in a time of trouble, of turmoil, of violence, of recognition of Florence's decline as a power. And this very much informed his thought, his attitude towards politics and towards life.
What were his family circumstances and his education, and how old is he at the time that he enters government?
Well, he was 29 at the moment he enters government, which by Florentine standards made him rather an immature man. Florentine men grew up very slowly. They given many years to sow their wild oats, and Machiavelli was very happy to do that. And so he enters public office in 1498, right after the fall of Savonarola. And Machiavelli comes from something that we don't really understand in this country or have in this country, but if you've read enough European novels of Tolstoy, you'll sort of recognize the type, the impoverished gentleman, the shabby gentility, sort of somebody just barely hanging on to respectability. His father had an estate, a small estate, a little farm. He had some connection with noble titles, but they were the Machiavelli, at least his branch of the family, was sort of poor, barely scraping by. Machiavelli felt this acutely, and I think much of his attitudes and his political thought comes from that sort of marginality, that sense of that he was just barely holding on to respectability.
But he is well-educated, and he is a brilliant writer.
He is well-educated. He had the humanist education of the times, well-schooled in Latin. He even had the typical Florentine training in what they called the School of Abacus, which was a school of applied mathematics, which was training for a career as a merchant, and most Florentines were merchants. But as Machiavelli himself said, he had no aptitude for business and therefore had to write about politics. So he was fluent in Latin, wrote in Latin often, and that's what actually landed him the job in the government, was his fluency in Latin, his fine penmanship, and that's really what was required. He drafted much of the correspondence of the Florentine government, and certainly a command of Latin, an understanding of Latin history, of Roman history in particular, was...
He becomes second chancellor of Florence in 1498. He has 15 or 13 subordinate secretaries. He's 15 years in office. Or mm-hmm. Talk about his work, his missions to France or to Cesare Borgia, and what are the politics like in the Italian city-states?
Well, first of all, it's probably useful to sort of tell you what the title he had meant. He was the second chancellor of the Republic of Florence, which was a small, fading power at this point, which meant he was something, I tried to think of the equivalent, it would be something like an undersecretary of state. He was not calling the policy shots. He was at the beck and call of the truly powerful men, the Medici and the Soderini, who ran things in Florence. And much of his work consisted of handling the correspondence of the government, but he was also used as a roving ambassador, a kind of troubleshooter, being sent to all the trouble spots in Florentine diplomatic relations, which were, there were many, particularly after the French invasion in 1494, where Florence was literally sort of barely hanging on by its fingernails, trying to survive as an independent republic in an age when the great powerful nation states were trampling them. it was a very unhappy experience in some ways. He described himself, and he wrote back to his bosses in Florence, that he and the republic he represented were treated as what he called Sir Nihil, which meant basically Mr. Nobody, Sir Nobody. They were laughed at, their interests were not taken into account, and it was a humiliating experience. And you know, much of his political ideas, this desire for a strong man that you see in the prince, comes out of a sense of impotence that he felt, that kind of, you know, having to represent a second-rate power that nobody took seriously. He was constantly embarrassed by his government's inability to commit itself to one policy or another. So he was forced to sort of go to the French court and sort of beg and plead for troops to help them in their wars after they had paid them many hundreds of thousands of ducats to hire their mercenaries. And so it was a difficult role. He loved the work, sort of was born to it, as he said. But it was certainly a difficult and humiliating experience for him.
Talk about his attitude and his relations with Cesare Borgia, the man whose life he models his own ideal of the powerful prince.
He meets Cesare Borgia in 1500. Cesare Borgia was the son of the Pope, Pope Alexander VI, and he had been a cardinal, and then he decided, well, the cardinal's life was not for him. He liked women and killing too much for him to make a good cardinal. So he may or may not have murdered his brother to leave the clerical life. Many people think that he suspect that he did. And then goes on to a career as a kind of freebooter in Italy. He comes in with the backing of the French king, with troops, and he basically tries to carve out for himself a kingdom in central Italy, which, of course, was frightened the heck out of the Florentine government, who thought they were next on his list. So Machiavelli is sent to the court of Cesare Borgia, and he meets the great man of the moment midnight in his recently conquered palace in Urbino, and he's is smitten. I think that's probably the right word. He sort of had a man crush on him. He had been dealing with his own cowardly government, frustrated and very aware of his impotence, and he sees this great man who had come like a sort of wildfire through Italy, conquering and killing and you know, bringing, you know, large swaths of unruly territory under control. He says, you know, here at last is a real man. I think it may have had something to do with his own personal circumstances as well. His father was something of a feckless scholar, and he sort of keenly felt that sort of sense of his own personal marginality, and he was really attracted to this handsome, dashing, bold, charismatic, ruthless killer, and it made a lifelong impression on him.
But at the same time that he's dealing not only with the French king, but with Cesare Borgia and Borgia's father, he's continuing to read history, Cicero, Livy. I mean, he's combining his thinking and reading with what he's observing.
Yes, that was typical of an educated man of his time, to look at contemporary events through the prism of the ancient writers, Thucydides and Livy, Tacitus. And this is simply part of humanist education. And if you read The Prince or The Discourses, you'll see that many of the examples are taken from, he'll compare a modern event and compare it to an ancient event. And the thinking at this time among educated Florentines was very much to do this. It offered a kind of parallel text. Instead of looking to scripture for your moral lessons, educated men like Machiavelli would look to Roman history for moral lessons, good men who triumphed and villains who got their comeuppance. And it was really a laboratory for them of human experience.
But his awareness that politics is human nature, human passion, as opposed to principled abstraction.
That's sort of, I think, the originality of Machiavelli, is to look at the ancients and look at what the ancients had written and look at various Christian takes on power and government written by people like Thomas Aquinas, Erasmus, Thomas More, though it's not clear he knew More's work. The Prince really comes out of a tradition of writing about government and writing about politics, and it's in deliberate imitation of that form. But he takes it in a completely different direction, and he does this very deliberately. Early in the Prince, he writes, "Since it is my intention to write of something useful to those of understanding, it seems best to me to go straight to the actual truth of things rather than to dwell in dreams." He's basically saying everybody before him dwelled in dreams. They talked of governments and states that never were and never could be. And he said he was going to set them straight. He was going to set the study of politics, of governance, on a new basis, one based in reality.
So if his fault was to be found, it was in his candor. He was willing to say what everybody else knew to be true but wouldn't say.
Right. That's certainly a lot of it. Something in his character, and I think that one of the things that makes him the least Machiavellian of men, and if you read his life, he was constantly stepping on people's toes and telling them exactly what he thought of them and their policies. He was very undiplomatic for a diplomat and very honest and straightforward. Even though he's known to be somebody who recommends deceit as a matter of policy, he himself was very frank and unable to flatter his superiors and get ahead that way. So the advice he gives to the would-be prince is very different from the way he actually lived his own life, which was to be honest and straightforward. And the book, The Prince, is in some ways the most honest book ever written. It was written as a job application to get back in the good graces of the Medici, who had overthrown the democratically elected government. And he thought that Lorenzo de' Medici would appreciate somebody who told it exactly the way it was. You know, somebody wasn't going to beat around the bush, wasn't going to fill his head with fancy abstractions that would do him no good, but he was going to tell him exactly what he thought from all his years of experience. And of course, that turned out to be a huge mistake, at least in terms of him finding a job.
Machiavelli served the government in Florence for 14 years, and then in 1513, he's dismissed and imprisoned and tortured. Explain briefly how and why that happens.
Well, he had been serving faithfully and devotedly the government of the democratically elected government under the leader Piero Soderini, and through a complicated series of events in which the Florentines typically backed the wrong army, the wrong nation. They're always backing France when they should have backed Spain. Eventually, the Medici, who had been expelled in 1494 during the beginning of the French invasion, got hold of an army. The Pope was angry at them. The Spaniards were angry at them. Pretty much everybody was angry with them. They took an army down to Florence and ended up sacking the neighboring city of Prato, driving back the militia that Machiavelli had created, and basically with a gun at their heads, telling them, you take back the Medici, who had been expelled. The Medici come into power. They fire many of the members of the previous regime, including Machiavelli, who had made many enemies already and was not well-liked personally, at least not by his superiors, because he had been so tactless. So he loses his job, which to him was everything. He was a political animal through and through. And then, unfortunately for him, his name was found on a list that had fallen from the pocket of a man named Boscoli, who was implicated in a plot to overthrow the new Medici regime. It's very unlikely Machiavelli ever knew about this. His sympathies were towards the democratically elected regime were well known. But he was not a man who went in for conspiracies. He tended to favor whatever regime was in power as the good bureaucrat that he was. His name was found on this list. He was arrested. He was tortured, almost executed, and was only saved by the fact that a few weeks into his imprisonment, Giovanni de' Medici, the head of the Medici family at the time, was elected pope. And feeling benevolent and they couldn't be touched any longer, they graciously released a series of political prisoners, one of whom was Machiavelli.
So he retires. He has a country farm not far from Florence, and he retires there for the last, 20 years of his life to write not only The Prince but the discourses and many other things, right?
Well, he keeps his house in the city. He does most of his writing at his farm in Sant'Andrea, which you can still visit. It's a wonderful thing. If you're ever in Florence, it's a beautiful little village, much the way it was in Machiavelli's day. And if you find the concierge, you can have her open up the house and take a look at I'm not sure the desk, as they purport, is actually the desk he wrote The Prince on, but the house is very much the way he left it. And to Machiavelli, who was a very political, very urban animal, this was like living in Siberia.
He dies in what year, 1527? How is he immediately remembered? I mean, people remember him as a satirist because he'd written comic plays.
Right. He was one of the great things about Machiavelli. One of the joys of Machiavelli is he was a very witty, genial, earthy guy, and it comes through in his letters. There's a wonderful letter he wrote to his friend Guicciardini, who's also the famous historian, in which he said, I just received your message while sitting on the toilet, contemplating the follies of humankind. And he had that sort of kind of earthy humor, that kind of way of looking at life, basically through a comic lens.
Soon after his death, his works begin to be condemned, and he's regarded as his first name, Nick, a name for the devil, the finger of Satan. Explain, how does he get his reputation that still clings to him as this cold, cynical, non-idealistic, inhumane operative?
As I've noted, I think it's an unfair characterization, but it's not something that's too difficult to discover in. It's there in his writings. He says a lot of shocking things. He recommends lying, deceit, even violence and murder of innocents at various points in The Prince. And that's the kind of writing that's going to get you a bad reputation, particularly in a world in which it's still dominated by the Catholic Church. He goes after the Catholic Church very vehemently, writes about how Italy has been ruined and Christianity has been ruined by the Church, by its corruption, by its meddling in political affairs. So early on, he was attacked by the Catholic Church, which put all his books on the index of prohibited books. You know, if you're going to speak these truths that other people may recognize, I mean, he did not invent lying. It's not that rulers and princes didn't lie before Machiavelli, but nobody before him actually said, this can be a good policy, this can be effective, this can work, not only for the prince himself, but this can be a viable strategy of political...
So his writing has come down to us for 500 years. It is said that he's the father or the godfather of modern political science.
Yeah. I think that's fair. I think what he did, and you have to understand, I think from, you know, if you lose the context in which he lived, many of the prescriptions he gives may sound harsh and terrible, but he lived in a very violent world. If you go to Florence and look at the buildings, you know, they're all, each palace is a fortress. This is because, you know, after centuries of violent civic life, people hold up in their palaces with their swords and spears and muskets. And this was the world he was living in. It's much more understandable that he would, you know, given the alternatives, judicious violence, violence that helps stabilize the state, deceit, all these things that, you know, the moralists would condemn, all of these things can work to create a better, more stable situation, a world in which people can actually live.
And so he emerges out of obscurity a little bit during his own lifetime, but is one of the major figures of the Italian Renaissance, together with Michelangelo and Raphael.
In some ways, I think our vision of the Renaissance is sort of schizophrenic. It's divided almost evenly between the sort of Chamber of Commerce version of the great artists Botticelli and Michelangelo and Da Vinci. And, you know, if you go to Florence, you certainly see that all over the place, the art. But you also see echoes of the violence, the kind of seamy underside. I mean, nothing that Machiavelli recommends, even at his most vicious, is anything like what actually happened among the princes who ran things in Italy. Machiavelli often said, people might say it's wrong to lie, it's wrong to murder the family of the person you've just overthrown, but if you can murder a few people and save a state, if you can save people the suffering of civil war, he has this famous line where he says, you know, Cesare Borgia was considered cruel, but the Florentines, in order not to seem cruel, allowed Pistoia to be destroyed. And he asks the question, you know, who is better, Cesare Borgia, who killed a few people and created a stable state, or the Florentines who were too squeamish and allowed the whole city to descend into chaos?
Thank you, Miles Unger, for speaking with us today about the life and thought of Niccolò Machiavelli. This is Lewis Lapham at Lapham's Quarterly from Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2011.